Welcome to the Daily Ben Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you?
I'm good, Nicholas.
Very good, sir. And Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you indeed. Nice and sunny in Cape Town today. I believe it's going to be warmer tomorrow. So,
indeed.
Yeah, all
much the same up here in Joburg. Hopefully, we have managed to resolve some of the tech issues that we had last time we had Mike on the show. So I think that we will be fine for today. So let's get right into it. And I think I'll start with you, Michael. So, of course, as many people know, and it was mentioned briefly by Gabriel on the show yesterday, there is trouble going down at Brackenfell High School in the Western Cape. The EFF is planning to protest what it says was a exclusionary whites-only party hosted by the school. However, the school and the parents there say that the party was a private party organized by some parents to make up for the fact that their original matric dance was cancelled, and that students of all races were invited, but only a few attended, and all of those happened to be white. The EFF clashed with parents who were very upset at the EFF protesting outside the school last time, and now they have vowed to return and make sure that nothing works. The EFF had a scheduled meeting with the Western Cape Education Minister, Debbie Schaefer, scheduled for today, I believe, but they cancelled it, saying that they have no time to talk to her as they are too busy organizing their event. Schaefer said that she believes the EFF only wanted to intimidate and disrupt schooling, and this despite the party making an undertaking in court that they would not do this. Schaefer said that they were aware of EFF leaders making repeated threats of violence on social media and on radio, and extensive preparations by police were being made ahead of tomorrow's protest. Police spokesperson Andre Truant said the officers would remain in the area until calm was restored. The circumstances surrounding an offense in terms of the Gallery Act and public violence are under investigation. Public order police were deployed in an area to maintain law and order and were forced to take action. The crowd was then dispersed and no arrests have been made yet. That was him talking about the altercation last week, Friday. But we also saw a protest yesterday by the Pan-Africanist Congress, the PAC, who made a rather unusual appearance. Michael, firstly, what do you make of the PAC emerging from wherever they've been, and what do you make of the whole saga itself?
Indeed. I don't think one is being unkind to say that the PAC is here desperately making a grasp for relevance. They succeeded in the last year's election in getting 0.18% of the vote and getting one seat in parliament, and it's kind of tragic in a way that the best they can do is to ride piggyback on the EFF in this instance, and contribute to the sort of racializing of debate and exploiting race in this way, which I think is really all it is. It is quite pathetic, almost, in a way that their first stumbling block was that they hadn't got permission to mount a protest, so they were immediately on the back foot there. But it does really underscore the irrelevance, to the extent that, you know, the plight of the voters that one imagines the PAC believe themselves to be representative of is really more the result of than anything else of post-1994 policy, and not at all the sentiments of a white-skinned minority, and particularly not parents of children at a school in Brackenfell.
Indeed. Terence, what do you make of the PAC returning, and what do you think should happen tomorrow if we want the story to have a happy ending?
I think this story and happy endings probably don't belong in the same sentence. I mean, it's rather like school children and police will be deployed. It's a thoroughly tragic, twisted, horrible situation. You know, I think the first thing is one should have all the facts in before indulging in speculation about what may or may not have happened. There do seem to be contradictory accounts. A place that most of the country had probably never heard of is now, has generated all sorts of op-eds on news platforms. Some claiming that they were subjected to the most vicious stigmatization during their time there. Others that had a wonderful time and couldn't believe that old Afrikaans wormies and tunnies were so nice to them. I don't know, but I think that it's. It's a symptom of a particularly dysfunctional politics where, anything that serves to drive a wedge can be guaranteed to be jumped on, where violence swims an inch deep below the surface. Ultimately, I think whatever happens. The loser is probably the school kids and the education system. There's another issue for people to be aggrieved about or to convince themselves they should be aggrieved about it. Very sad.
So I'm a bit concerned about what's sort of going on here in the larger picture, and that the EFF in particular is deliberately waging a campaign at this point to undermine race relations as much as possible, and to enhance its the perception of it as a powerful force in the sense that it's physically powerful and able to deploy people. I've heard anecdotal stories of other schools now also being identified by the EFF, where a teacher has a misunderstanding with a parent or something, and the EFF now threatens to descend. Employers have a dispute with a worker, the worker gets fired, and the EFF threatens to intervene to ensure that the worker is appropriately treated in their eyes. And we've seen now a bunch of these campaigns being waged by the EFF ever since the Clicks one. There seems to be a sort of pattern that the EFF rolls one out almost every month now. Michael, do you think this is a very deliberate campaign? And if so, what do you think its ultimate goal is?
Yes, I do think it is. And one of the thoughts that immediately comes to mind is how striking it is that the government itself has said very little. And, the impression one gets is that this is clearly a useful distraction. It's something that they themselves can in a secondary sense, perhaps, exploit. It certainly takes attention away from what the real issues are in the country and the real problems facing the people these parties vow to represent. And I think, Terence's point is absolutely correct. The question of facts, establishing the facts of these things, tends to recede, take second place to the spectacle of posturing and rhetoric and so on. And it does become so easy for these relatively small parties and parties that are advancing a point of view that is clearly contrary to the national interest to gain this attention. There's much less questioning than there should be of what exactly has happened here. What are the real facts, and what does it mean? I was thinking just last week again of the Clicks protest, and I think you'd be really hard pressed to find a single news report subsequent to the Clicks protest, which actually points out that all four of the pictures on that controversial ad were pictures of candidates for hair improvement or for the product that was being advertised. It wasn't as if the advertisement was saying the pictures of the white women represent great hair and the pictures of the black women represent hair that needs attention. The fact is the ad was selling a product to four categories of hair problems. But this is completely overlooked. It's a fundamental fact at the heart of the whole thing, which just fell into the background because it was accepted that there was a race problem. And I think that point about facts, I think, and interrogating what exactly is happening, tends to take second place to, as I say, the sort of spectacle, which falls right into the lap of parties that are willing to exploit race.
You know, I think
Terrence,
it's also
I think
in terms of the narrative that the EFF has latched onto, and I think it's one that has been taken up by many of our thinking people. You know, if all you have is a hammer, everything becomes a nail. You know, you will find a racial explanation. Or yes. You will infer a racial explanation, or even if the issue can be shown not to have been intrinsically racial or even tangentially racial, it is possible to still use it as a racial learning experience. You know, I think that there is a huge ideological and emotional investment in this. To demand evidence is seen as almost as being at the very least in bad taste. Having said that, you know, if indeed it is true that that no black or coloured students were invited to this, I think that in itself raises some very serious questions. But I do think that one should also go back to the sort of first principle. You were protesting a school, but the school apparently had nothing to do with the event that sparked the controversy. It's as if a mousetrap of narratives being woven, where you're caught in one particular avenue, and you simply can't get out.
Indeed,
it's very depressing.
So my question, I guess, to either of you actually is this. Those of us who care about sort of racial healing in this country and peace and law and order and all those good things, what should organizations, civil society, political parties do to resist these EFF tactics? Because they seem pretty effective at dividing people.
Yeah, I think it's very true. I mean, Terence is quite right to say, you know, that in all these instances, often there is an element of, or at least there is a sense of a kind of unreconstructed racism, if you like, people who do still have racial attitudes and so on, and which we certainly as the IRR reject and have done a great deal over the years to confront. And yet one of the perverse consequences of the way that it's being dealt with today, not least by the media itself, is that the very thing that is apparently the target of these gestures is in fact inflamed and worsened and continues perhaps below the surface, instead of there being kind of rationally confronted and challenged. The alternative that we see now is simply conflict and people kind of hardening their attitudes, which is distinctly unhelpful.
Definitely, Terence.
I went some years ago. I attended a sort of friendship circle group by someone I know in passing. About these sort of issues, mostly people of my generation, probably a little bit older, most of them white, talking about race in South Africa. And one after another, there were confessions of, I'll never be anything other than a recovering racist. And I then put up my hand and said, look, you know, I think that what's missing from this is rationality and evidence. You know, if there is a problem, let's define the problem and then let's look at whether a solution is possible. It may be emotionally satisfying for you to confess your racism, but what exactly are you doing?
Exactly.
You know, And the lady sitting next to me, who I gather formidably well educated and successful, said, "I think we need to abandon the idea of reason and rationality, and just go with feeling." And I said, "Well, you know, if that is the case, then we cannot have then we cannot expect discussion, and you know, accept the outcomes, and they will not be happy ones."
Yeah, well, that's really not the way to go. That's down a rabbit hole from which we can never really escape, I suspect. Exactly. Any final thoughts, Michael?
I think just finally, I mean, drawing on exactly what Terence just said, that, you know, reason and rationality, my sense really is that people who genuinely do share a stake in society and who share in the goodies and the opportunities and so on, do, just as a matter of human nature, find a way to see their relationships with other people in ways that do not rely on the kind of tribalistic and the fearful and the threatened and so on. And that if we really want to deal with a society or create a society which interests are shared in this way and that racism falls away, it is really precisely creating a society in which everybody really does have a stake and they do have these opportunities. And we know that we don't have this kind of society today. And that's really comes down to policy. It's the kind of stuff that Terence writes about all the time. The foolhardy gestures of the government, which so often, in fact, hurts their own supporters more than anyone else. And it just undermines this entire project, which is, we certainly think, achievable.
Definitely. And that's why we fight so hard for all those economic reforms. Right, let's move on to our next topic for today, which is the level of household debt owed to municipalities across South Africa. A report from our relative organization, the CRA, talked about how local government revenue and expenditure preliminary results for July of last year to June of this year revealed that aggregate municipal consumer debts amounted to 191.5 billion rand. The largest component of this debt is households owing municipalities a total of 133.9 billion rand. A lot of it is no longer realistically collectible, considering that the debt is older than 90 days. And if a household debt is limited, the realistically collectible amount, let me just say, is only at around 18.5 billion. So municipalities, they're in a lot of trouble. Consumers are in a lot of trouble. It's been a difficult year for a lot of people. Terence, firstly, why do you think we got to this place? And secondly, what do you think we can do about it?
Well, it's another very depressing subject, and it's a long-standing source of depression, because when I first went to work for the Institute of Race Relations in 1997, for those of you, that was pre-WhatsApp, and not everyone had their own internet connection. Cell phones were still something of a status symbol. One of the first projects that I worked on was about municipal government financing, and this was during a time when the municipal systems were still being put in place, and all sorts of possibilities were open. But I remember at that point there was already a question over the fiscal viability, particularly the crisis of liquidity. You had an organization like the Joburg City Council, massive assets, but essentially the non-payment that had taken hold in the 1980s was never reversed. I remember Joe Slovo in 1995 saying, "Well, now that we have a democratic government and we're talking about development and everything, people will come through." Didn't happen. The Masakane campaign in the 1990s. Masakane, let's build together. The idea that people would pay their bills, and in exchange they'd get great services. Essentially. this just came to be taken as a source of household credit, not just household. A lot of businesses copied, cottoned onto the fact that you could sort of get away with not paying. Unfortunately, the sort of strategy of accommodation and, you know, levying nominal nominal amounts, which themselves weren't paid, and then, you know, it gets to a point where it's just politically uncollectible, so you write it off. You know, that became the way things were done. And I think, you know, what's happened is that we have not seen the economic takeoff that that we should have. You have households that are in straitened circumstances at the best of times, and after COVID, I mean, it's just a complete disaster. You know, and they've been able to enjoy services, often perhaps low quality, but, you know, better than nothing, without paying. And I think that, just rationally, they would say they've got more important things to devote their very constrained, constrained, budgets to. The thing is, though, this is now crawling into the middle class. People who would sort of grin and bear it, you know, are I think really, you know, greatly affected by things like electricity shortages, problems with the water supply, potholes. It's the sense that you pay a great deal and you don't get much for it. Their household incomes have not been keeping up with the municipal bills. It's not a happy situation. I use that phrase a lot, don't I?
Well, it's kind of appropriate for the time, I think.
It is indeed.
Michael, my question to you is, I think, you know, anyone who's dealt with local government, particularly in a place like Joburg, you know that the municipality often struggles to, you know, issue the correct bill in the first place. There's lots of people in Johannesburg who have double bills, who pay their bills, but it never gets taken off their account. Or who occasionally get crazy bills, like there was that famous story where a few years ago someone got a bill which was just his account number, which means that he would owe sort of 100 million rand or something. So I'm a little bit skeptical of these figures, actually, because I actually don't know if municipalities are able to issue bills and collect on them even vaguely accurately. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a perfectly valid point of view. It's kind of speculated on those lines. I mean, we know from the Auditor General's report just how poorly run so many of the municipalities are. Also, I read a lot of these things from the perspective of living in Cape Town, and I know that there, you know, plenty of ratepayers are not necessarily happy with what happens here, but I think there is quite a striking contrast between the way Cape Town is run and the way so many other towns and cities are. So it's really, as Terence says, it's a deeply unhappy situation. I'll tell you something that did strike me this week, though, was reading Rob Rose's story in the Financial Mail, which really focused on what he sees as a rising payment revolt. And as Terence also noted, it's shifting into the middle class arena. But in particular, a comment made by the economist Mike Schussler, who says, and I'll just read this, he says, at some stage, the debt, and we're talking about 158 billion, and this is the amount of debt outstanding for more than 3 months owed to municipalities. Divert briefly, Rob Rose notes that this bad debt amount has grown 164% over the past decade, and which is more than three times faster than inflation. So Schussler observes this. He says, at some stage, this debt will be written off and charged as an expense to consumers who can pay. And he says that when that happens, bills will increase again above inflation, more households will not be able to afford it, and so gradually more people will not pay. And he then adds, and in this way, more people will be forced into a payment revolt. So this, to me, kind of introduces a quite a new dynamic. The piece itself mentions the situation in the Eastern Cape in Meccano, where a civil society organization went to court and succeeded in having the municipality placed into administration. And the piece also quotes Wayne Duvenacher of the organization Undoing Tax Abuse, OUTA, as saying that they are now beginning to focus on municipalities and holding municipalities to account for pushing through ludicrous fees and so on, and not delivering services. So it's quite an interesting shift, I think, that as people feeling the pressure, as the pressure mounts, there could be this shift towards much greater activism in the civil society sphere to demand better from municipalities, or even just to take over services and then charge the municipality. So it's quite an interesting scenario that we're confronting.
Indeed, and that's something we've actually talked a little bit about on the show before. The most notable case of which was in Harry Smith, where
that's
the community
right,
took over repairing municipal infrastructure. Let us move on to our final topic, and that is, of course, our old nemesis of this year, COVID. So we talked a little bit on the show about how we were hoping that South Africa might have achieved some sort of herd immunity and the worst has passed us. The jury's still out on that question, but there have been some worrying signs recently, which suggest that our infection rate is rising. We've seen our positivity rate in the country, which had dropped. That's the number of tests that have come back positive. Had dropped to about 7%, and it appears to have dropped, shot up now to around 9-10%, somewhere around there. Most of it seems to be focused in the Western and Eastern Cape again, which is a little bit concerning because those were areas that were hit hard previously. And now there's an awful lot of speculation about whether there will be a second lockdown. Health Minister William Kesey said he was extremely concerned about the latest daily numbers of COVID infections. Kesey said at this point, health officials believe that they could still contain the cluster outbreak in parts of the Eastern Cape, like Nelson Mandela Bay Municipality. Kesey said, I'm very concerned, and I think it's important that all South Africans be very concerned. The real issue is the numbers should be going down and stabilizing or staying steady at a lower level. Therefore, something we did right in the beginning will probably be people taking the message seriously. At this time, it looks like complacency is coming. He went on to say that the government has not made a decision yet on whether they're going to do a return of stricter outcomes and lockdown during the festive period. So I guess I'll start with you, Terence. Terence, do you think we might have another lockdown?
Oh, I think it's a possibility, but I would say that they'd probably be very, very reluctant to do so because I just don't think it would work. I think that the damage done by the first one, nothing, and the sense of dissatisfaction was such that I don't think that they would have that initial goodwill that sort of kept the country, in a sense, or a lot of the country, voluntarily locked down for those first couple of weeks. And I think, you know, over Christmas, I just don't see it working. I think you would generate a lot of resistance, a lot of resentment, and a lot of sort of rule breaking. Mm. I mean, are you going to ban booze over Christmas time? I'll say this: that would not be a happy situation, and I'm basically totally.
Michael, what do you think?
Yes, I absolutely agree with Terence. We ran a very good piece by Ivor Fechter this week on the Daily Friend, a kind of penetrating analysis of the lockdown, and it's essentially its failure that the virus actually spread through the lockdown, and that clearly going the lockdown route is not the way to go. Yet he underscores the point that you know this is actually a dangerous disease, and it's not a conspiracy and it's not a myth. It really is there. His own wife is in the medical sphere, and she has treated people, some of whom have recovered, some of whom have died. So, it is a real thing, but it's clear that the lockdown approach is not the way to go. That really what you've got to do is get society on your side, adopting basic, sensible health practices, wearing masks, social distancing, washing hands, and so on. And yet, at the same time, keep the economy going, because that also ultimately represents a kind of health risk of its own. So yes, I agree with Terence. I think it would be foolhardy. And if anything, what the government has really got to do is make a concerted effort to get people to understand that there are things they can do, and they're quite simple things, and this is the way we should go.
Right, and do their best to rebuild trust in them after all of this nonsense with COVID corruption and arbitrary lockdown restrictions.
Exactly.
Right, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. Next week, I suspect we will cover whatever happens tomorrow at Brackenfell, as well as the drama today that's unfolded with regards to Zuma and the Zondo Commission. Anyway, apart from that, I hope that tomorrow ends up being a damp squib for the EFF and a day of reconciliation for the rest of South Africa. And we will all see you next week. So thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.